I had a lot of wondering that I did when I was thinking about this story this week. I wonder about this man who was living in the tombs. I wonder if he knew that he was possessed. I wonder if he had any consciousness at all, or if the demons had taken over completely. I wonder if the demons came one at a time, slowly, almost imperceptibly, or if they came all at once like a tidal wave over him. I wonder if there were times when he glimpsed sanity just long enough to be scared or sad or confused. I wonder if he felt the cold or his sunburned skin or the raw wounds where his body persisted against the chains. I wonder if he was lonely. I wonder if he had a family back in town worried about him, or maybe they'd given up on him. Did they visit him among the tombs? Did they stand at the edge, hidden, watching to see if he was okay? I wonder what his life was like before the demons. Did he have a job? Was he a skilled laborer or a teacher or a businessman? Did he have a wife? Did he have children? Was he religious? Who was this man? At first, when we're introduced to him, all we know is that he's possessed. That's everything that Luke tells us about him. And it's not just any possession. He's possessed by a legion. That's a word that brings to mind a legion of Roman soldiers, an occupying army that would have been 6,000 strong. He is out of control. Even the chains and the shackles can't hold him for long. He's strong, or at least the demons don't care if he suffers physical pain in exchange for breaking the chains. I also wonder about the pigs. I wonder why Jesus cast the demons into the pigs. Didn't he care about pigs? Or about the livelihood of the men and women who owned the pigs? Couldn't he have just as easily cast the demons back into hell as put them into pigs? I wonder a lot of things when I read the stories in the Bible. So let's go back to the beginning. Jesus and his disciples have just survived a storm on the Sea of Galilee. In fact, they had only survived because the disciples, in fear, woke Jesus up and he commanded the waves and the rain and the wind to be silent, and it obeyed. They'd landed on the other side of the sea, on the western shore, in what we know as kind of the southeastern edge of Syria. They were outside of Jewish country. When a man who was wild, naked, frightening even, was the first to meet him. Now, interestingly, the word that Luke uses that we translated as the man met him or to meet him is used elsewhere to reference a hostile meeting between enemies, usually in the context of a military engagement. This is how the man met Jesus, like he was about to go to battle. He wasn't welcoming them to the beach. He wasn't offering them hospitality. He was an enemy. He was there to intimidate them, to chase them away. But Jesus is not so easily intimidated. This is the same Jesus, remember, who only hours before had commanded the wind and the storm to cease, and it had obeyed. Before the man even opened his mouth, Jesus knew about the demons. He'd already commanded them to leave. He didn't wring his hands in worry. He didn't back away in fear. He just told the demons to get out. And the demons pleaded for mercy. Can you imagine that? The demons pleaded for mercy. See, clearly they knew who Jesus was. Clearly they knew that they did not stand a chance against this man. If this truly was a military meeting, as Luke's language suggests, the demons knew they were the inferior army. They knew the only way they would survive was if Jesus chose to let them survive. So Jesus did something kind of surprising and weird. He asked the man his name. But it was the demons who responded, not the man. "We are legion," they informed him. "We are an army," they may as well have said. Imagine what this scene, this encounter, would look like in our city. a sip outside of the tombs in the ancient world, and come back to Toronto. Position Jesus, if you will, outside the Queen Street Mental Health Center, or in a doorway in Parkdale, or in a stretch of grass in Regent Park, or under the gardener. And a man begins to approach. You smell him before you see him very clearly. The soles of his shoes flap as he walks. His fingernails are broken and blackened. His clothing is worn and stained. His knuckles bear the scars of numerous fights. His eyes are dull and unfocused until he sees Jesus. And then he moves with intensity, with a touch of ferocity. His defense is up. It's attack or be attacked in his experience. And something about Jesus triggers his violence, his defensiveness, his self-protection. But Jesus doesn't run away from the man. Jesus doesn't even move, except perhaps imperceptibly closer to the man. And the man stands before Jesus, pulling himself as tall as he can, doing his best to intimidate Jesus. But Jesus stands his ground, not like the man stands his ground, seeking to intimidate an enemy, but calmly, quietly, his posture relaxed and peaceful. And he says to the man, "What is your name?" Can you imagine what that was like for the man? Everyone else, every other single person was afraid of him. Everyone else skirted around him. Everyone else dropped their gaze when his dull, defiant eyes looked at them. Everyone else left him alone. But Jesus is not everyone else. Jesus asked him his name. Imagine you are that man. When was the last time you spoke your name out loud? When was the last time anyone called you by your name? Do you even remember who you are? Do you remember a time before? A time when people didn't fear you or run from you or lock you up? Do you remember a time when your thoughts were clear? When your body and your mind were in sync? How do you answer when Jesus asks you your name? See, a name is so important. A name is who we are. A name is identity and worth and humanity. A name sets the person apart from the beast. When was the last time this man, this beast, had heard his name spoken out loud? When was the last time someone had used this man's name as anything but a curse? Jesus asked him his name. But it was the demons who answered. Was the man so lost even to himself that he had become his demons? Was this all that remained of his identity? Had he become Legion? I wonder how many of us have experienced the kind of pain, the kind of suffering, the kind of brokenness that so overwhelms a person that they lose themselves for a time. Do you know what it is to become the thing that plagues you? Do you know what it was like for this man among the tombs, this man everyone had given up on, this man who had become his demons? Do you ever find yourself looking at your life, looking at the way you're living, and wonder, even just for a moment, who am I? If Jesus asked you right here and now, what is your name? How would you answer? Who are you? Would you tell him your job title? Would you tell him your family name? Would you tell him your diseases? Who are you? What is your name? Who are you when no one is looking? What name do you long to be called in the lonely stretches of the night? Who were you before you lost yourself? Before something in you died? Before the pains and joys and busyness of life took over, do you even remember? Jesus asked the man burdened and oppressed by a legion, a multitude, a swarm of demons, what is your name? And the demons answered. Similarly, Jesus asked us, what is your name? How do we answer? I want to read for you from the words of author Debbie Thomas. What ails us as human beings is legion. The evil that haunts us has many faces, many names. We are all, every one of us, vulnerable to forces that seek to take us over, to bind our mouths, to take away our true names, and to separate us from God and from each other. Some of us suffer from depression or anxiety. Some of us are addicted to sex, alcohol, wealth, or thinness. Some of us experience the world at a deafening volume in colors too lurid for our sensitive eyes. Some of us are slaves to the internet, or prone to bitterness, or caught up in cycles of dishonesty, or in lust with our own rightness. Some of us can't shake traumatic memories. Some of us were abused as children. Some of us are seething with jealousy. Some of us are imprisoned within systems of injustice that stretch back so many centuries we can't even imagine liberation. Some of us experience our skin colors, our accents, our genders, or our sexualities as magnets for other people's hatred. Some of us suffer illnesses that crisscross the boundaries of medicine and culture, nature and nurture. Some of us know exactly what the Apostle Paul is talking about when he writes, "What I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, that I do." What is your name? Have you become your demons as the man among the tombs had become his? Now, after telling Jesus their name, the demons begged Jesus not to send them to the abyss, to hell. They begged Jesus for mercy, and so Jesus sent them into a herd of pigs. What? Luke writes it like, of course he did. And the demons drove the pigs crazy, to the extent that the pigs, en masse, ran into the water and drowned. Really? Told you it was a weird story. First off, something I learned this week, pigs actually know how to swim. They're good swimmers. You learn a lot when you research a sermon. In fact, according to the National Geographic, there's an island in the Bahamas that is home to dozens of feral pigs. No one knows how they got there, but these pigs love to swim. And people take tourist destinations to this uninhabited island to swim not with dolphins or sharks, but pigs. If he can get it to work, hopefully Justin's going to show us a little YouTube video at the end of the service. If you want to go there, you can go to the island and swim with pigs. So even though the pigs ran into the water, they shouldn't have drowned. They can swim. But they did. The bigger question, though, is why Jesus allowed it at all? Didn't Jesus care about the pigs? Didn't he care about the livelihoods of those who owned the pigs? Didn't he care about the people who would go hungry without the pigs? Now, some have suggested that Jesus allowed the demons to possess the pigs so there would be no question as to the destructive power of evil. Really? Surely, having witnessed and been forced to deal with the possessed man all this time had been less than enough. I don't think anyone who encountered the man would have questioned the destructive power and nature of evil. Some have suggested that Jesus was making a statement about the uncleanness of the demons by casting them into unclean animals. I don't know about you, but that seems a bit obscure to me and kind of pointless for the Gentile population who witnessed the whole thing, for whom these rules around uncleanness weren't a thing. Some have suggested that the pigs were nothing more than unfortunate casualties of war. But honestly, that just doesn't quite fit with everything else that Scripture teaches us about Jesus, at least not in the way that I read Scripture and understand Jesus. Now, I admit that it's possible that I have been a little bit too influenced by Disney and the personification and humanization of animals that Disney does so well. It's possible that my feelings about the pigs are completely alien to Jesus' day and time. And yet, even if the pigs were just pigs, even if Jesus hated the pigs because he was a good Jewish man and all Jews hated pigs, we still have to deal with the fact that people's livelihoods depended on the health of these pigs. And we know that Jesus cared about people, even Gentile people. So what do we do with this? The demons begged Jesus not to send them to hell, but to instead send them into a herd of pigs, and Jesus allowed it. And the pigs went mad and drowned. I wonder if the point here is that there is a cost when we battle evil. I wonder if the point is that there's a cost when we seek to free people from oppression, from whatever demons possess them. I wonder if the point here is that there's a cost to our salvation, and not just the cost that Jesus paid on the cross, but the cost we pay as his followers. In Luke 9, Jesus said this to his disciples: "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will save it." The demons that possessed this man were powerful. They were legion. They had robbed him of his humanity. They had broken him, isolated him, and stolen his name. But they were no match for Jesus. And yet, the man's freedom, the man's humanity, dignity, and restoration to community came at a cost. It cost the people their wealth. It cost them their comfort. It cost them their security. And it didn't just cost the man's family or his friends or his closest neighbors. It cost the entire community. Is this what frightened the people? See, when they found out what had happened, they begged Jesus to leave them. Luke tells us they were seized with great fear. Why? Surely seeing that madman, that man that they had been so afraid of, clothed, restored, and sane, should have been cause for great rejoicing. Why didn't they bring Jesus everyone else who was sick or possessed? Why didn't they beg him to stay and do more? Were they afraid of the cost of it? It can't have been pleasant for the people, knowing the possessed man always broke free of his chains. It must have been frightening to go to places this man haunted. What if you stumbled into him by accident? Had he hurt others in the past? How much damage had he done while possessed by the legion of evil? And yet it seems that one possessed man, at least semi-controlled and predictable in his insanity, was more preferable to the people than the cost of his freedom. This is not an easy story for us to enter into, because it's not a comfortable story. It starts out great. Jesus is once again asserting his authority over everything that's wrong in the world. Yay, Jesus, we can stand back and watch the events unfold, cheering in the bleachers. We know Jesus will win. And then enter the pigs and the people who didn't cheer. And we have to ask ourselves if there's anything of them in us. If they were our pigs, if it was our livelihood that Jesus messed with, would we still be cheering? What cost are we willing to pay for other people's freedom? What if the other isn't my family, doesn't go to my church, isn't someone I like even, or at least isn't someone I really care about? What cost am I willing to pay for that person's freedom? What do I care about more? My own wealth, my own comfort, my own control, or my fellow human being's freedom from whatever demon or demons possess him or her? I wonder what it was like for the man who'd been possessed. What was it like for him to know that his freedom came at the expense of his whole community's wealth and prosperity? No wonder he begged to go with Jesus. Who would you rather be with? The people who'd known you at your worst, who knew you at the insane as the insane beast they chained and feared, who'd been forced to pay a very high price for your freedom? Or Jesus, the man who'd conquered a legion of demons with a word, the man who'd saved you, who'd restored your humanity? Who would you rather go with? By far, the easier path for this man would have been for him to go with Jesus. Even knowing what we know about Jesus' death, even knowing how hard it would have been for this Gentile man to be accepted and to follow a Jewish rabbi, it was nothing, I don't think, compared to entering the community, to returning to the people who'd witnessed him at his worst. I wonder how long it took, how many months or years before the people believed the man was really healed. I wonder if they jumped in fear every time he had an angry outburst or an off day. Are they back? I imagine them whispering to each other. Should we lock him up just to be safe, just in case? I wonder if they continued to avoid him. if they warned their children to stay away from him, if his was the house on the corner the teenagers broke into on a dare. I wonder if they made him pay for the lost pigs. I wonder if he felt indebted to them for the rest of his life. I wonder if he traded one kind of oppression for another. I wonder if sometimes late at night, when the world was quiet, he still heard the whisper of his demons, maybe a memory, maybe something more. I wonder how long it took before he truly believed the demons were gone for good. After all, just because he'd seen them drive a herd of pigs to their deaths didn't mean they couldn't come back. But Jesus told him to return to his home and tell his story. So that's what he did. And he didn't just tell his story with words. His very presence was the story. If he'd gone anywhere else, people would have doubted him. Maybe they'd have thought he's exaggerating how bad it was. But here, among his own people, among the same people he'd terrorized, no one could question the change Jesus had wrought in this man. Tradition tells us that Judas, not Iscariot, as he's referred to in the Gospels, one of the 12, went to Syria, among other places, after Jesus' ascension. I wonder if he ever went to the place where this man had lived. I wonder if he established a church in the region this man had lived in, built on the foundation of this miracle Jesus had performed when he cast a legion of demons into a herd of pigs. I wonder, what does this weird and wonderful story from Luke 8 have to say to us here today in Toronto? First, I think this story challenges us to identify with the possessed man. It challenges us to consider what in our lives is keeping us from the abundant life Jesus said he came to give. We may not literally be possessed by demons, but that doesn't mean we're free. It doesn't mean we're not oppressed. What is it in your life that you need freedom from? What in your life do you need Jesus to release you from? The second thing we take away, I think, is a reminder that Jesus was not afraid of the man's demons. He wasn't afraid of the man. Instead, he asked the man his name. He initiated a relationship with a man while the man was still possessed. I think sometimes we forget that Jesus doesn't require our holiness in order to love us. He doesn't require our perfection or our sinlessness to be in relationship with us. He wants into our lives, into the mess of it all, because he loves us even in the mess and violence and ugliness of it. The story challenges us. Have you let Jesus into your mess, your ugliness? And the third thing, as followers of Jesus, we're supposed to be like Jesus. We're supposed to care about the oppressed, the hurting, those relegated to the margins and the wilderness places. And we're to care more about them than we do about our own comfort, our own wealth, or our own safety. There's a cost to this kind of caring. It's an individual cost, but it's also a communal cost. Are we willing to pay it? Who is it that Jesus is confronting us with? Whose freedom needs us and our willingness to sacrifice? In Matthew 14, there's a great story about Jesus and Peter and a boat. And in the story, the disciples are on a boat on the Sea of Galilee, and they see this ghostly apparition coming toward them, walking on the water. But the ghost speaks and lets them know that he's Jesus. At which point, Peter, at Jesus' invitation, jumps out of the boat and walks across the water toward Jesus. This story is a great one on so many levels, not least of which is the message that following Jesus is at times frightening and risky. It requires that we get out of the boat, whatever safe, comfortable place that might metaphorically be. If we're to be in the same place as Jesus is, doing the same things as Jesus, we have to get out of those safe places, out of the boat. We have to be willing to take those risks. I can't help but see parallels between that story and this one of Jesus and the demon-possessed man. If Jesus and his disciples hadn't landed on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, the non-Israel side of the Sea of Galilee, if they turned around and gone back to the Jewish side of the sea, the safe side, the demon-possessed man would likely never have experienced freedom. He would likely have died among the tombs, driven to his death, much like the pigs were driven to theirs. If we don't risk getting out of whatever boat we're comfortable and safe in, if we don't risk stepping onto the shores of unfamiliar territory with unfamiliar people, the people who most need the freedom Jesus offers may never get it. Who is it that's waiting for us on the shores of an unfamiliar place? Who's waiting for you? Are you willing to pay the price of another person's freedom? Is there anything Jesus may require of you that's just too precious, too important to give? I think this story about a demon-possessed man and his suicidal pigs challenges us to look deep and honestly, to ask if there's anything we won't do for Jesus. If there is any price that's too high, any cross that's too heavy. Consider these words from Luke 9 again, further in that chapter. As they were going along the road, someone said to Jesus, "I'll follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." To another, he said, "Follow me." But he said, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." But Jesus said to him, "Let the dead bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim the kingdom of God." Another said, "I'll follow you, Lord, but let me first say farewell to those at my home." And Jesus said to him, "No one who puts a hand to the plow and looks back is fitting for the kingdom of God." Is there any price that's too high? Any cross that's too heavy for us?